him outside to talk. He brought him forward, the speaker, and I'd like to introduce Greg, our speaker.
Get him down there pretty low.
Hi. My name is Ray. I'm an addict. Oh, thank you. The first thing, I never think about what I'm going to say, so it might go anywhere. But one thing that I always do at the beginning is I welcome the newcomer, right? And I encourage you to keep coming back, because that's what they did for me. And boy, I needed a lot of encouragement if you're anything like me, right? So just to hear that and to come in and be new and get an occasional hug, that meant a lot to me. So if you're new, I would encourage you to keep coming back. If you can't stay, you know, the literature suggests that we stay clean in between meetings. If you can't do that, then keep coming back anyway. And if you're loaded in this room tonight, welcome to Narcotics Anonymous, okay? No. I don't go into a lot of my past history of my using career, because I don't think that you get here and stay here unless it was a serious problem. So, you know, a lot of our using career is pretty much really, the circumstances might be a little different, but everything behind it was pretty much the same. Like, you know, from the neck up, we're all pretty much the same, right? So we got the same kind of head, we think the same way, and all that self-centered and fearful kind of thinking when we were using, and even after we're not using, right? Because I tell people, I came into Narcotics Anonymous a dope fiend, and you took the dope away, and I've been working on the fiend for 29 years, right? Yeah, so my clean date is September 7th, 1987. That's a direct result of Narcotics Anonymous, because left to my own devices, I use drugs. So, you know, that's because of NA. And I was one of those people that, just like the literature talks about, like nothing else worked for me. This was it. This was the last house on the block, and it fucking worked. All right. I'm glad I'm not the first one that said the F word, too, by the way. Because sometimes that's the only word that describes it for me. Right? So I guess the things that are like remarkable, and what I mean is by worthy of remark about my active using, was a couple things. I did not have to go to jail, and I did not have to put a needle in my arm every day to get to Narcotics Anonymous. But boy, did I hit a bottom, right? That's what it took. I had to hit a bottom. And by the time I got here, my brothers described my skills as a series of half sentences, grunts, and noises, and I was pretty destroyed, you know, mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally. And so my first meetings in Narcotics Anonymous were in 1983. My brother was also an addict, who, by the way, died from this disease, like many of our family members, even after he got clean, like many people in Narcotics Anonymous. And so I white-knuckled it for my family for 6 months, and I was in outpatient treatment, but I wasn't, and I was going to meetings, but I was not, that's all I was doing. I didn't have a sponsor, I wasn't working a step, you know, I wasn't fellowshipping, I was just showing up, and I didn't really want to talk to anybody. But, and then I went out for, until 87, I went out in late 83, I put 9 months together. And I was coming home from a gig, and there was a guy standing in front of a Shop and Go or something, and he asked me if I'd buy him a six-pack of beer, and he had a handful of pills, and the next thing I knew, he had the beer, and I took all the pills. So I went back into therapy the next day and admitted that I'd relapsed, you know, and so they were pretty concerned, seemed to be pretty concerned about that, and wanted me to go into inpatient treatment, but don't you know, I had too much shit going on in my life to take that time out for myself, right? You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't worth that, right? There was too much other stuff going on, I thought. So, One of the interesting things about the relapse, and I see this all the time. You know, I tell people about relapse. I said, I got really bad news for you. I said, the bad news is you might relapse and fuck your life up so bad that you could never make it back here, and you just stay in that zombie land of fucking using for the rest of your natural life, and I can't even imagine what that would be like. And then the other thing is the disease progresses in me, whether I'm using or not. So I don't have the luxury of like picking up where I left off. It's as if I had never stopped, right? And that's pretty awful. And I've seen that hundreds of times in Narcotics Anonymous. And so part of that is my own experience and then a lot of observation, right? Because we're good observers, aren't we? Yeah, we are. We are. And that's a good thing, because there's many people in NA that taught me what to do, and then there was many people in NA that taught me what not to do, right? And I needed to see both of those, right? Because I had a hard time, if you were like me, I had a hard time with discernment. Like, the first year was terrible. And I don't say that to like discourage anybody. It's just my experience, right? I mean, I'm not an expert, you know. I'm not the spokesman for Narcotics Anonymous, but I have my own experience, and that's really all I have, right? So anything that I know about recovery was one of a couple things: either something that I read in the literature, something that I heard in a meeting, or some of it was born out of my own personal experience of staying clean, right? So. The first year, I was just, you take the drugs away, and man, I was worse, because I didn't have anything to suppress all that emotion and shame and guilt from the past, and it all just came up, man, and I did anything and everything to divert myself away from reality, right? So that whole obsession thing about drugs, like it would attach itself to anything else, right? You stop the dope and then the fiend is off. And so I did things like play video games, you know, incessantly to just, or watch TV or, you know, just to, and emotionally it was terrible, you know, and the good news was is that there were a lot of people in NA that cared about me. And there have been people in this program that have poured unbelievable amounts of time into my recovery. And I could honestly never pay them back. But I learned that if I'm to do that, I need to pay it forward, right? So there was a certain amount of what I was taught in my earliest part of recovery that I saw these people that devoted a certain part of their life to service, right? And I just, it was hard to understand. I certainly didn't feel worthy. Because if you're anything like me, this whole idea about a higher power here, I mean, that's one of the penultimate, you know, decisions to make here. Because I don't know about you guys, but that real obsessive, that obsessive compulsive behavior, I mean, that's insanity, right? That's just insanity. And there was nothing that I could really do about that. I needed to become willing to allow a higher power come into my life and change that, right? And I put every ounce of self-will that I had into not, you know, using. But the real answer came when I made my first surrender in Narcotics Anonymous was to this. I always say, God, as I do not understand Him today, because I have a lot less of a concrete idea about what it is, but I have a lot more proof that it works, right? And that's good enough for me, because I always say, if I woke up this morning and the first thing that I thought about was not about the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more, that's all the proof that I need that there's a higher power. Because that's amazing. That's the miraculous, right? And it's been a long time since I woke up and felt like that, right? So, but this whole higher power kind of idea, like when I came into the program, I had a lot of preconceived notion about what, number one, religion was. I'd never heard of the concept of principles before personalities. So what I was doing, I was being very unfair to everybody. I was judging them on their behavior and not on the principles that they were trying to practice, right? So that's, I heard that first here, and that began to change my mind. And one of the interesting things was that I'd always believed that there was some, this power greater than ourselves, but for me, I didn't feel like I was worthy of approaching it for the help. Like I was supposed to be in some other condition other than the way I actually was. So that first year, God for me was the group of dope fiends. Because these people, Narcotics Anonymous knows way more about staying clean than I do, right? And that worked. That was enough. That was enough to get a foothold, right? And then I had, like a lot of stuff in NA, I got railroaded into getting a sponsor. And so I got a sponsor, and he was kind enough to get together with me every single week the first year, and we worked a step a month, right? Now, what actually came out of that, I'm not so sure. Well, I know for sure that it wasn't very thorough, because my first four step was 3 pages long. So, but it had the desired effect, and this is, I always believe this about, this has been my experience with the steps. I don't have to like it. I don't have to even believe it works. I just need to do it. And it is going to have the desired effect. It's going to reveal to me what needs to be revealed at any particular time. And that was out of my own recovery and working with hundreds of addicts since I've been here. And it was a very consistent thing. And so the analogy I always use is it's like going to a gym and you walk in, you pick up you curl a weight and it's going to build the muscle. It doesn't matter what I think about it. I don't have to like it. I don't even have to think it's going to work. I just need to flex the muscle and it's going to work. Right? And that's how working the steps was, is it just worked. Right? I just kept flexing the muscle. So the one thing I know for sure in that first year when I was doing this first introduction to the steps is it laid the groundwork to cyclically work the steps over and over and over again. And I mean in an informal way with sponsors, right? And then what finally happened out of working the steps is that I didn't really have to work the steps anymore. The steps worked me. Right, so the principles that are embodied inside all of the literature that we have, it started, those principles, I practiced them more consistently, and I just started doing more of the a positive thing in my life. Because this is very interesting to me too. So, because my background as a kid, you know, I had parents that I could not have known that they loved me anymore. So it was a little Beaver Cleaver, and if you know who that is, you just dated yourself. But, and then I have for lots of friends that their childhood is horrific. I mean, it's terrible, right? And yet we both turned out to be addicts. Very interesting. So the one thing that showed me is that in spite of all that, there was something else, and it was the personal thing. So through a lot of inventory on early childhood stuff, like I can't tell you why, but I can tell you when my head broke. And what I mean by that is when I started interpreting life way too self-centeredly at about 8 years old. And I don't know what the fuck happened, but I just know it happened. And finally, I quit asking why, and I just accepted the fact it is, and let's go from there. Right? So those answers weren't, it took a while, but those answers weren't very important. And trust me, if I'm not anybody that has those kind of childhood issues, they need to be addressed, right? I'm not saying that to minimize what anybody in this room went through in those years, because some of it, stories I've heard and sponsees that have shared, it's just tragic, right? But the thing about if you're an addict like me, like we travel around with a lot of pain, right? And it's unprocessed pain. So that first year, when you took the drugs away from me, all this unprocessed pain started coming up. And I don't know, I thought the emotions were going to kill me, right? They didn't, but I thought that they might. Because I was really afraid of that, right, to experience them. And what I found through my experience is that emotions are meant to go through them and not to avoid them or not to stuff them or not to, you know, ignore them. Is that the fastest way out is through, right? So today I'm much more like immediately emotionally attached to what happens in my life than I've ever been before, which is it has its pluses and its minuses, right? Because anybody that has stayed here for a while, I was just talking with somebody before this meeting, and they said that they stopped counting their friends that died at 35. Friends, and I get it, because I know I've had 50 of my close friends, and these aren't just people that I went to meetings with. These were people that were at my house, that I knew their children, that I knew their dog's name, right? And even as I describe this, in the last 6 months, I've had 3 sponsees died that were all younger than me. And you guys are, a lot of you are very aware of one of them, Jeff H., that loved you guys down here by the, and I know you know it. But that was one of those situations that was just yanked out of my life. And it left a major hole in my life, right? But I get, every time I talk about it, I feel emotional about it. But I always share with people in the program that, you know what, I hope that you make friends that are close enough that affect you in that way. Because, see, when I was using, that wasn't possible. See, when I'm using, I'm not capable. I'm not capable of being there for another person. I'm not capable of processing my emotions. I'm not capable of being a good friend, right? None of that shit happens. Why? Because the only thing on my agenda is to get fucking loaded, and that's it. And that's a 24/7 job if you're like me. And so all this other shit falls to the wayside. And I never got to the point in using that, like I was a complete sociopath where I didn't care, but I couldn't help myself in the most literal way, right? I could not help but go cop again. So it took me coming to this place, exactly this place, that was the only thing that worked for me. And I found my recovery solely through the meetings of Narcotics Anonymous. But I'll tell you, but the other thing is that the 12 steps of the NA program were the springboard into my investigation into the spiritual world, so to speak, right? So at some point, I've read dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of books, right? I did my own homework, right? So the great thing about Narcotics Anonymous is a major plus, is that this is God as we understand Him. It's not as I understand Him, right? So we can have completely different concepts of a higher power, but we can coexist, right? In this program, and encourage you. I encourage everybody to go do their own homework, right? Go find out what works, and if it's working, don't fix it. And if it's not working, then fix it, right? So, I'm never, you know, I used to be afraid in meetings to talk about my higher power. But what I like to do is I'm not specific about my higher power, but the one thing I'm specific about is the traits of my higher power. Because early on, that was one of the things that really helped me, as my sponsor told me, well, if you're having a hard time with the concept, why don't you just write down some things that you want your higher power to be, right? I want my higher power to love me unconditionally, right? And this was a really important one. I wanted my higher power to forgive me, right? Because for this addict, forgiveness is one of the highest spiritual principles that I can work, right? And I wanted my higher power to have a sense of humor, which definitely does, because I don't know about you, but sometimes the ironic part of life, it's just like, you're kidding me, right? This can't really be happening, right? So here's how my higher power has a sense of humor. I've been a musician my entire life. I turned pro when I was, I started making money when I was 13. I just turned 63. That's what I've done my entire life. I've been really fucking lucky, right? So, at some point, a buddy of mine wrote a great song that was a tribute to anybody that wore a badge. So we played in Fresno. We played at the christening of the fallen police officer memorial. And there were officials from all over the state. Well, it caught fire. And we went up and we did the fallen police officer memorial in Sacramento 8 times. Here's the sense of humor. I did the California Narcotics Officers Association convention for 8 fucking years. Okay? That's weird. No, and I had 14 years when the first time I showed up, and I was so fucking scared and self-conscious that I stayed in my room, man, because it was the whole downtown Sacramento was narcs. It was fucking 5,000 narcs, man. And I'm looking at them, and I'm figuring, well, they know who I am. But you know what? I had to get over that self-centered part before I could actually participate in that, right? And when I actually started participating in that, it was a major spiritual experience, because the last year I did that, we did the memorial, and then I got to sit down and have a lunch with family members of police officers that were being put on the memorial that day, right? And I got to stand there, I got to sit there and listen to them, and that's what I did. I listened to what they had to say, and it was pretty incredible that life had come around 180 degrees like that, right? Only through Narcotics Anonymous, though. No other way for me. This was it, right? And then one of the other, and this is a little far-fetched, but it happened. So you see these things, I don't tell these stories to make myself look good, because what happened is that this is where I was inspired or directed to go, right? This wasn't my plan. If you would have told me that plan 2 years before I showed up at the Narcotics Officers Association, I would have told you, you're full of shit. But I'll never do that, right? They'll never have me do that. So we did the Staples Center for the LA County Sheriff's Department, and the next day was a Super Bowl Sunday, and we went down to Calexico, which, man, is the Wild West down there. And we played for a guy named Kiki Camarillo, his family. Kiki Camarillo was the first DEA agent that had been kidnapped and murdered by the Mexican mafia in Mexico City. And by the way, his family is solely responsible for Red Ribbon Week in the United States after that tragedy. That's what kind of people they are, right? So it was a very small memorial, and so I get, I'm more nervous. Talking to you guys than I am playing, because I can see the whites of everybody's eyes, right? So it's a really personal experience. Well, this thing was just like that. It was very small, 150 people. His widow was there. This was 20 years after he was murdered. His widow was there. His children were there, and one was a mucky muck with the DEA, another one was in the DA's office in San Diego. His old partner was there, and his brother was there, who, by the way, was one of us. So they got both sides, right? So we went in Sunday, and we had we went to a barbecue where all these, it was just cops, right? So we roll in, and they start doing introductions, and yeah, my name's Chris, so I sang the song. This is Tony, he wrote it. And just offhandedly, he looked at me, and in front of all these cops, he goes, and this is the Shank. So for the next 36 hours, that's all I heard. Every cop that walked up to me, hey, Shank, what's up, man? And then when we came home, we were on the San Bernardino side of the mountains, and we passed Shank's Road, and we passed Shank's Auto Supply. And then the final nail in the coffin was I went home. My son was about 14. I told him. He goes, that's great. He goes, I'm going to school tomorrow. I'm going to ask one of my friends, say, what's your dad's name? What does he do? Oh, he's a plumber. His name's Bob. My dad's a musician. His name's The Shank. And I hate to say the pun, but it stuck. That's my stage name, The Shank, and that's how I got it, right? Very interesting. So anyway, that night we went back to the hotel, and I had this dream, and I don't know, it was one of those hyper vivid, like real. You know, when I woke up, I wasn't sure if it had really happened or not. And the dream was that I was at this memorial, and I was sharing with a kind of a faceless police officer. But I was sharing just like I'd share in a meeting like this, like very direct and, you know, about my past and that kind of stuff. And so it kind of it agitated me. And so I told my friends about it, and they thought, "Well, that's a little crazy." So we went to the did the memorial, and then afterwards, I walked up to one of my friends. I said, "Hey, I'm compelled to walk over and talk to this guy's family. Do you think I'm just being self-centered, and you know, that that's not the time, not the place?" He just looked me straight in the eye, and he goes, "Well, I think you should follow your heart." So I walked over, and I had an hour conversation with his family that you wouldn't, if you were standing there, you wouldn't believe, because not only did I share truthfully about how far I had come to get there, but they shared a lot of their family history with me, which I didn't earn, you know what I mean? Like, I wasn't their friend, but they were very open about it, you know, so I tell those because that's just one of those God stories. I mean, you can't write those scripts. They just happen, right? And if you're like me, a lot of stuff like that happens. You know, my concept of a higher power, you know, I have this little finite mind, and I think that things are supposed to look a certain way. I could be very rigid, very scheduled, right? And the higher power always seems to be just like standing behind me, just kind of, you know, smiling and waiting for me to realize that, hey, there might be a, you know, there's a whole world behind me that I'm not even aware of, right? And so a lot of times the God thing for me comes in the back door because it's the unexpected, it's the unplanned, it just unfolds, right? So at some point for me, in service, like that's what it became, is that the plan of service, in me participating in service, it just unfolds. All I'm supposed to do is show up. Today, all I'm supposed to do is show up here. I have no fucking idea what's going to happen, right? The ideal thing is that maybe I can get past my little self-centered rings of fear and actually, you know, participate and this spiritual thing that happens in NA. And you know what? If you're relatively new and you haven't felt it yet, man, I hope you stay long enough that you do fucking feel it, because it's definitely here. It's definitely here. I can walk into a meeting sometimes and it just, you know, it'll bring the hair up on my neck, right? I've had people ask me about group consciences. Well, how do you know if I said, oh, I've seen a lot of group consciences, and I don't think many of them have been God consciences. I've seen a lot of personality consciences. They go, how do you know the difference? I said, the hair on the back of your neck's going to fucking stand up. That's how. Right? So, I'm really glad to be here. I'm really glad to be surrounded by people that understand how my head works, right? Because if you're anything like me, this is the center of my disease. The center of my disease is self-centered, egotistical fear, right? If you're an addict like me, and when I react, I go to worst possible scenario and I backpedal because I'm a classic negative thinker, right? But there's a big difference today between my reactions and my responses. See, I still don't, even with 29 years, you paint me in a corner, and when I react, I'm not really going to react that well. You know, you tell me what to do, I'm going to say, fuck you. That's my first reaction, right? I still have that rebellious streak in me, like, you know, what the fuck do you know? don't you know who I am? And they go, and they generally go, yeah, I do know who you are. That's why I'm saying that to you. So I have that, you know, I've kicked and screamed and resisted every step of the way of working this program. But here's the great thing. The great thing is about a degree of willingness, right? One of the jokes between one of my sponsees and I is we always look up words. They always told me, if there's a word that I don't know the definition, look it up and write it down and put it up on my refrigerator. So we were talking about willingness. He called me back. He's chuckling. He said, yeah. He says, one of the definitions for willingness was enthusiastic compliance. And I thought, well, I don't know how fucking enthusiastic I've ever been, but I got the compliance part down pretty good, right? So what that meant is that I didn't have a perfect degree of willingness. I had just enough willingness to crack the door open to see that there was another room in there. And eventually I could squeeze through that door and there was a whole nother level of recovery that was happening that I had no idea about. Right? At 17 years, I did a speaker meeting at the Alano Club in Fresno, and my oldest son was a Marine for 10 years, and he went to Iraq 3 times, and he went to Afghanistan once, and he saw the most horrific urban combat that you can experience. And so the first time he went over, I did the speaker meeting about my relation. It was a tumultuous relationship with him, and it was one of those things. It didn't turn out for a long time like I wanted it to, right? I think a lot of us, when we come in, we yearn to have family back, right? And that doesn't always work out, because that's not the promise here, right? There's one promise, right? Freedom from active addiction. That's it. It doesn't mean we're going to get a fucking car, a relationship, or a job. It doesn't mean anything but exactly what it says, right? But here was the interesting thing about the freedom from active addiction. After you took the drugs away and I started just addressing the fiend, right? And how the fiend can attach its obsessive compulsive behavior to everything else, or that when I came in, you took the drugs away, that I had codependent issues, right? Then I was able to, like, address those things. But the first thing that had to happen is I had to get fucking clean and stay clean, right? That's first things first. But what I found out over time was that that was not any kind of a full or rich recovery. Because you take the dope away and I don't change anything, I'm fucking miserable. I'm miserable. I go through the same thought patterns I did when I was using. What's the difference? I did not, I'm sure you've heard many people say, I didn't get clean to be miserable, right? But I'm still capable of being miserable, and here's why. Because to me, the hardest part of the 12 steps is the very last sentence in the 12 step. And practice these principles in all of my affairs. Holy crap. You're kidding me, right? All of them, right? So I always say, not just the ones that I like, but the ones that can be very hard, or they could be awkward, or the ones that I'm ambiguous about, which means I don't know where I morally stand on something. I have minor moral dilemma all the time. I need to dig into my program and find out where I really am with this, right? Because my black and white thinking turned into some gray, too. There's a lot of gray in life. That's what I found. So, and then, finally, the ones that I will temporarily, absolutely, positively refuse. Fuck you. Right? And what happens when I do that? I give up my peace of mind every single time. And you know what? It doesn't take very long for me to stay in that place to realize this is where I used to live. Right? Now I just go back and visit occasionally. Right? Yeah. So I'm just I've got a visitor's pass. And I usually get to get out, right? Because either I get in enough pain to work it, or I have one of my cronies sock me in the head and tell me what I'm doing. It's like, oh, okay, yeah. That level of identification, you know, when it talks about the therapeutic value of one addict helping another, that is without parallel, I found that a very high spiritual principle for me working with other people in this program is the spiritual principle of identification. Because to see it, I have to be it, right? So I have to have a streak in that my personality before I can ever see that in another human being. And it allows me, when people know that, that I've replaced the word judgment in my vocabulary, and I've replaced it with identification. They know that I can say things directly to them, and I'm not judging them, I'm identifying with them, right? I can sympathize or empathize with that, right? So it allows me to be very direct and say things that maybe some people, they would be offended, but they're not, because they know where I'm coming from with that. And that's an interesting thing. That's one of those things that it could either be an asset or it could be a defect, right? Well, when it talks in the literature that my worst defects can be turned into my best assets, how did that happen, right? I didn't understand that at all. Well, what happened is when I start taking the self-centeredness out of it, it became something else, right? So that obsessive compulsive behavior that we have, that big streak, when God came in and I gained a little bit of an off and on switch, then that became things like hyper-focus, tenacity, right? So those are major assets. That's a lot of addicts, they go back to school, they fucking A school. Why? Boom. Because they do a lot of homework, man. Because that's it, you know. It's that hyper-focus, right? So that can be an asset or it could be a defect. So to take that self-centeredness out of it is what can help make it an asset. And that's only through the higher power. Because I'm completely convinced of this. For me, this has been my experience. The center of this program is the sixth and seventh step. It's the center of the program on person, on purpose. It's symbolic because the real change in my personality came through my investigation into the spiritual world. And the strange dichotomy is that I've had people ask me this, if the higher power is all powerful, why didn't he just step in, right? Yeah, because he was fucking waiting for me, right, to surrender. Is waiting for me to surrender. So the interesting thing, and I feel this way about service. See, service is God's work. So it's none of my business. So there's this whole thing about there's part of my life that's none of my own fucking business. I don't get that, you know. Like, that's weird. That's a strange dichotomy, right? But it's true. Whatever service I do, it's none of my business. I don't have to sponsor anybody. I don't have to do any speaker meetings. I don't have to do jack shit. I don't even have to stay clean. And I know that might hurt some people here, but it's a fact, and here's why. Because I was partially restored to sanity, I could have the ability to make a decision and choices, right? A conscious decision. When I was using, there was no breaks. That's all there was. So the choice had been taken away from me, right? So if you're an addict like me, you understand exactly what I'm saying. And people that have never experienced that are never going to know what we're talking about because they haven't experienced it yet. I think it's a moral problem. If you just wanted to stay clean, well, fuck. I wanted to stay clean for the last 10 years I was using, but I couldn't do it by myself. I had to come to this place, Narcotics Anonymous, which is all over the world, right? So, real quick, I'm gonna just finish this story about my son. So I did this speaker meeting about my relationship with my son, and I had people come up and ask me, "Well, aren't you staying up nights, like worrying about him being over in Iraq?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well," they looked at me like, "What? You don't care about him?" And I was like, "No. That's not what's happening. What happened was at 17 years, it was the biggest surrender of any issue in my life that had ever happened, and I didn't even know it." right? That was from cyclically working the steps, and eventually they worked me. That was I cannot think my way into right living. I have to live my way into right thinking. So what happened was I bought the farm here. I did everything they told me to do, right? And I lived my way into my mind changing about it, right? And that went, and at 17 years, when I realized that, I stood there and I thought to myself, what else have I missed in this program? The depth, right? The depth of this program, as far as I'm concerned, is endless because it has to do with the higher power. My little finite brain, I'm always going to cap off my own experience unless I open my mind up. That's one of those three spiritual principles here that we can't throw away, right? Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, right? With these, we are well on our way. So I had to have this open-mindedness about living my way into right thinking. And I couldn't even identify that. I had to have somebody else told me that. They said, well, Ray, you lived your way into right thinking. I'm like, I've said that 1,000 times and I didn't even realize it. But somebody else had to identify that for me, right? Because there's always that one part of my recovery I am never going to see without you guys. Never. It's that in that Johari window. It's the pain that you can never, you know, it's the blind side. And so I need outside perspective from you guys to be able to help identify that, right? And it's only through the help of addicts, rooms full of addicts just like you guys, is the reason that I get to stand up here and I get to have 29 years clean and I get to have this relatively amazing life. I toured for 20 years, right? I get to play music for my living. You know, there's a lot of this outside stuff, these other gifts, right? The one promise, many gifts. So I was gifted many things in my life, but the main thing that I was gifted is I was gifted many friends in my life, right? And I mean real, you know what, if you've been here for a minute, you know exactly what I'm talking about. These friends that when they pass, it really means something to me. It really affects me. I really feel it, and I really miss them, right? Which I could never connect like that before, ever. And it was from being here that I got to do things like that. So I'm going to cut it off there, and I really appreciate you guys inviting me down here to share. And I love you guys, man, and I'll keep coming back. Thank you.